this week on the Backtable Podcast.
I think if you're really using this technology, the mechanical technology, and even now with aspiration, I've always been of the mindset of starting more proximal and working distally, which, I think in the interventional cardiology training was always you start distal and work prox. This is a situation where, I want to use that obstructed outflow kind of as my safeguard as I debulk what's ahead of me. I don't want to just plow through that street and then just try to deal with the aftermath of things showering. I want to just start proximally, debulk thrombus, take another interval picture, try to decide, run your IVUS down again, see where your level of, open vascular structure is now, and then just keep working. So prox the distal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Backtable Podcast. If you're a new listener, welcome. For all of our regular listeners, welcome back and thank you for listening. You can find all previous episodes of the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or our website, which is backtable.com. Very easy to remember. Subscribe to the show, leave us a review, or reach out to us on social media. Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
When you need to restore flow in an ischemic limb, there's no time to lose. You need the Pounce thrombectomy system. The Pounce system from Surmonix is a purpose-built percutaneous device for removing thrombus and embolus in the peripheral arterial vasculature. No capital equipment or aspiration needed. Just grab, go, and restore flow. It's simple. With the Pounce system, you place the basket wire distal to the clot, place the collection funnel proximal to the clot, pull back to collect the clot in the funnel, and retract the system through your guide sheath. The secret sauce? The Pounce funnel is designed to macerate and dehydrate the clot, allowing you to remove even large amounts of material through a 7 French sheath. Visit pouncesystem.com to learn how physicians have used the device to accelerate on-table flow restoration while reducing use of thrombolytics. Pounce thrombectomy. Strike quickly to capture and remove clot. Now, back to the episode.
Our topic today is acute limb ischemia, and specifically we're going to be talking about using mechanical thrombectomy to treat this patient population. Our guest today is Dr. Dean Ferreira. Dean is an interventional cardiologist working in Indiana. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Dean, just as an icebreaker, will you tell us about your practice and kind of what it looks like, and then we'll kind of drill down on the actual topic.
Absolutely. So interventional cardiologist, as you mentioned, all of my training was done here in Chicagoland area. So yeah, I practiced in Northwest Indiana, which is a stone throw from Chicago. Did my interventional cardiology and general cardiology training at University of Illinois Chicago. Got my hands dirty there doing the robust practice of interventional cardiology, coronary, and mostly peripheral as well. I'm not a structural trained guy, so my practice focus has been on managing complex coronary disease, cardiogenic shock, and also critical limb ischemia as we've come to treat it in the local area.
Nice. How long you been out? If you don't mind me asking, Dean.
No. We got to be honest, right? So finished training at July 2012. So we're looking at we're coming on 12 years of practice.
Nice, that's very it. Nice. So like your first job at a fellowship, it was at this practice that you're at now, and hospital based, lab based, private practice based.
No, my first job. Well, this is my second job, and both positions have been a hospital medical group employed. First one was with a large employer in the area, Advocate Medical Group. Was really fortunate to take on a job right where I trained. A lot of my training was at Christ Medical Center on the south side, southwest suburbs of Chicagoland, and was very fortunate to get on staff there, join a practice there, and then just got a phone call one day from a buddy of mine that I trained with, and he said, hey, we have a good opportunity just across the border, and it was an extra 10 minutes in the car, so why not? Took a look at it, liked it, and been very happy there as well. So I've been at the Community Care Network in Northwest Indiana for the last 5 years now.
Very nice. All right, so let's jump into it. So acute limb ischemia, or ALI, it's a broad topic, but we're going to kind of narrow it down. But if you would, Dean, will you kind of just go over like a for your practice specifically, like a typical patient presentation and how you get alerted, and then we'll jump into workup.
Absolutely. So most of our patients come through the emergency department. We are kind of the first call as interventional cardiologists at our hospital. And I know that's unique, but a lot of hospitals operate differently. We do have good surgical backup. So it's the usual patient presentation is somebody that comes in through the ER with symptomatic leg pain, and the ER physician will typically contact both myself or one of the interventional cardiologists on call for the group and one of our cardiovascular surgeons. So we approach it as a vascular care model. The two of us will usually then talk, develop a workup plan and a management strategy from there. But the majority of these cases are coming to us through the ER.
Okay. Once you've been alerted, does the ER kind of have a standard workup? Like what's typically been done and then what needs to get done for you guys to kind of get a care plan up and, or, you know, ready to go?
Well, you know, since we do these cases, if it's going to come to the interventional cardiologist, since we do these cases in the cath lab, we, you know, of course have a cath lab team on standby for all sorts of call. But a lot of the workup is done, you know, from the ER doctor, just getting usually a CT angiogram from the get-go. If there's some renal insufficiency and we have the, you know, labs back pretty quickly, we might opt for a stat arterial duplex. We have the capability of doing both. So we kind of just manage that on a case-by-case basis. You know, one patient might have good kidneys and we have no problem getting a CT scan, which is a little bit more fruitful. Others, you know, we have the concerns about renal insufficiency. We know there's a good chance they're going to go to the cath lab. So we'll try to favor an arterial duplex first if we can get that. And if it's really somebody that's, you know, unstable that has to go sooner than later, you know, we don't really delay, but we do want that first piece of data to know what our approach will be like.
Okay. If you had a preference and like, just say like the ER doc or however they present, maybe it ends up in your clinic somehow. If you could just start out and have anything, what would you be your workup? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, why do you like CTA or duplex over one or the other?
I mean, I think it's just a matter of really deciding where your level of disease is. You know, where's your level of obstruction? I mean, we can figure a lot out on clinical exam, of course, but, you know, if you have femoral pulses or if you don't, if you have popliteal pulses or if you don't. But, you know, we all know that these are complex patients presenting with a complex disease state. And so if we have the luxury of time of getting a CT, it's generally preferred because then from the get-go, we know where our highest degree of obstruction is, where our access is going to potentially be, what the aortic bifurcation might look like if we have to come up and over, certainly if we are dealing with a heavily calcified vascular structure, we can get all that information pretty quickly.
Gotcha. If I could back up and just talk about HMP, I know that some of this legwork has already been done, but just for our trainees out there, can you talk about what a focused HMP would look like for a patient like this or a vascular path? Like, what are some of the things that, I mean, maybe some of this changes what you're going to do, or maybe some of it's going to change like the care on the back end, but just kind of the basics of what you're looking for with your HMP.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so, you know, in general, you want to know vascular disease risk factors. I mean, I think that goes without saying. So you're going to try to ascertain a history of diabetes, a history of dyslipidemia, any kind of high-risk history, such as, you know, prior coronary event, prior stroke, any prior vascular interventions that have been done, whether or not they're actively smoking, I think is still a big deal because it's a big point of education, right? We don't want to miss an opportunity to say, you're in bad shape because you're smoking. Let's try to modify this. But then for me, and I think for, you know, many of this audience, I mean, we also want to know what's been done. I mean, what kind of procedures, if any, have been done to this vascular patient in the past, be it endovascular or open surgical, because it obviously changes completely how we assess, access, manage that patient.
Exactly. All right. We're kind of past the HMP. We're past the workup. Oh, I guess I should back up and say any lab work that's mission critical that maybe hasn't been ordered. And we kind of mentioned like, you know, a GFR, a creatinine, anything else that you'd like to know?
I like a lactate level. I think it gives you a lot of information to just get a sense of how acidotic this patient might be from an ALI event and the degree of ischemia, you know, the degree of myelolysis here, you know, comes into play. A CK as well is usually in my order set, but in general, I favor, you know, first knowing what's my hemoglobin, what's my creatinine, what are my platelets looking like, and, you know, how acidotic is this patient? It's kind of a marker of how sick are they, right? So
sure.
To me, it's an important lab.
Okay. After that, so we have some different ways to treat these patients, and I'll kind of lay them out, and then, you know, we'll drill down on endovascular approach, but there's conservative management, endovascular, and then maybe surgical. And I know that we're talking to a lot of different doctors and maybe not all of these are available at different hospitals depending on availability or, you know, doctor availability or cath lab availability. But can you kind of just talk like in very, very broad strokes about the different ways that you might manage one of these patients?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the first piece of information is, you know, how threatened is the limb? and what's the degree, or rather I should say, what's the level of threat? You know, so somebody that is, you know, presenting with the classic, you know, pain, pallor, pulselessness, really more about looking leg where they can't move, can't feel. I mean, that is somebody that is extraordinarily high risk. And from there, it's time of onset. I mean, if they've been, you know, sitting at home all night, you know, waiting around for this to maybe get better and they didn't, and then they finally can't take it and it's been over that 4 hour mark a little later, you know, we know that there's a higher degree of muscle loss at that point, and our options from an endovascular perspective, in my opinion, can be a little bit more limited, only because you know that even if you're able to extirpate clot or whatever the issue might be, you still might be looking at somebody who has a more bound leg that might need to go to the operating room for fasciotomies or something, you know, more definitively surgically. In the case of those who are threatened viable, but still have some motor function, you know, those patients, you've at least know that you're in a position to, if work earnestly and quickly, that you can really reverse that process a little faster. And so those are the ones that we like to jump on a little bit faster and get into treatment after looking at their scans or trying to decide what to do in an angiogram suite. Then we can at least decide as a vascular care team, is this going to be a primary endo approach or a primary surgical approach?
So that's actually kind of what I get into the heart of. And kind of what I'm hearing is that like a lot of it's like driven by acuity and like what the limb looks like. But do you kind of work with like your vascular surgery colleagues to determine like kind of who takes the lead? And are there any, like, do any of the vascular surgeons have like a surgical or endovascular option that maybe for some reason, like on the, like while you're doing the workup, you're like, oh, this is a better fit for you guys than it is like interventional cardiology. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think it comes to the thrust of who, you know, who owns the patient is somewhat system specific. I mean, at our institution, we have great open surgeons. They don't do anything endovascular except for AAAs. So, you know, for the most part, they're going to defer anything endo to us. And other institutions, you might have vascular surgeons on site that are going to be able to do both themselves. You might have just the primary IR team. That's the first call. In our institution, it's you know, interventional cardiology. So very institution specific. And I think that's why we try to both engage, you know, from the get-go and say, look, let's just talk about this. Let's collaborate. Because, you know, the last thing we want is any kind of, so to speak, turf battle on this. I mean, we really want a collaborative approach. And so with my institution, you know, Community Hospital in Munster, Indiana, we were very fortunate to have that combined approach. We have good dialogue from the get-go. And then it's not uncommon for our surgeons to come walking into the cath lab as I'm taking pictures. And then we collaborate and discuss, you know, what do we want to do next? So that's, I guess that's where the rubber meets the road on that one, Chris.
So say ER calls you 2 a.m. And you have a cold leg. And I guess now what I'm trying to get to the heart of without like creating like every possible patient scenario is how quickly are you guys getting in gear to take these patients back if they are appropriate for like endovascular treatment? Is it like STEMI situation where it's like, let's get everyone in as quickly as possible? Or are there some conservative things that you can do while you're kind of like treading a little bit of water until like everyone gets there for daytime work?
Awesome. So great question, right? I mean, I think, you know, the level of acuity dictates when we hop on it. So our group of interventionalists, I mean, we treat it like a STEMI. So if we do have, so to speak, the cold leg, the proverbial cold leg with the classic Ps, I mean, those are the patients that we're activating the lab, we're coming in at night. I'm typically speaking to, you know, my surgical colleague on the way in and just saying, hey, I'm going to shoot some pictures, then I'll give you a call, that sort of thing. And yes, we don't wait to the morning on those. If we have, you know, more of like a 2A little threatened viable limb, but the patient is relatively comfortable and we know that there's still some good motor function, maybe they just have some paresthesias and there's a little bit more of a softer presentation, you know, that's where it's going to be a conversation with the ER doc, whoever the referring doc is, nursing staff, keeping an eye on everything, looking at labs, anticoagulating that patient, and then perhaps they'll go in the morning. But they have to not be at such high risk for limb loss, if that makes sense.
As far as anticoagulation for patients who, before they've been taken back to the cath lab, do you have any like tips that you can offer as far as conservative treatment, like just for that time in between notification, workups getting done, and but before they've gone to the cath lab?
Not much. I mean, we're a heparin-based lab, so, you know, we're going to mostly you just start a heparin based protocol from here.
Yep. So let's get into like the meat of it, like the procedure part. Anesthesia wise, patients, I would assume either local or moderate sedation.
Yeah, correct. And that's a hot button issue. I mean, every once in a while you can get into a scenario where you're the patient's in so much discomfort that, you know, we're calling for anesthesia support and at night and we've done that. I mean, there's a lot of these cases that we can start to work on with typical moderate sedation, but if they're really mobile on the table, there's a risk of bleeding. I mean, as you know, with the types of drugs we're going to be using and the risk of bleeding inherently from any endovascular procedure, we need that patient to be stable and comfortable. So if we can't get them comfortable, we can call our anesthesia support. If we can get them relaxed enough with moderate sedation, you know, that's how we prefer to work.
So after that, I know it's tough to know, so you can create whatever patient is kind of easier to kind of get the point across, but I was thinking room setup. And basically I want to know is, you know, is it like if you're treating left leg, or are you more, you think it's better to go up and over or anti-grade, and a bit about room setup and like access site?
I think most of these cases are contralateral. If I look at a CT scan and it's a tough bifurcation and I have distal thrombus or distal occlusion, then we might opt to go antegrade. But, you know, the road has to be clear, right? So if the road is unknown, contralateral is our typical friend. So let's say it's a left, you know, iliac or femoral occlusion, you know, we're going to be accessing right, and we're going to take our initial angiograms from the distal aorta to make sure there's nothing there that's concerning, paying attention to our interventional exam, as I call it. How's my wire feel going up? Is there any signs of anything else blocking the road? And then proceed with our intervention, typically contralaterally. I would say our routine access would be 5 French until we get up, get some pictures, get the lay of the land, and then decide what we want to do next.
So your first picture, you said you shoot from the distal aorta. I see some people who will do like an abdominal aortogram, and they actually like include like the mesenteric arterial vasculature. But if you don't have any reason to suspect that there's clot like in the renals or the SMA or IMA, you just distal aorta shoot, and basically you're looking for runoff.
Generally, yes.
Okay.
Generally, yes.
Got it. So I really like what you said, and I'll go back to it. The interventional exam. So, you know, like how the wire feels going up and over.
Totally.
All right. So I do want to get into that when we're talking about crossing clot. So you've shot your picture. So it's right groin access. You've shot your pictures from the distal aorta. You have an occlusion. You can either pick iliac or femoral. What next?
Well, I think, you know, we determine, you know, where's our collateral bed, if any. You know, hopefully there is some collateral bed, and it increases a chance of limb salvage there. If we have a flush occlusion, obviously looking for the classic meniscus sign, you know, we can engage it as clot, appreciate it as likely clot. Sometimes we're fooled. You know, these patients come in and you think there's just clot there, and obviously there's a lot more work to be done crossing through a subacute thrombotic leg or something that is definitely a little bit more chronic and calcified. In general, we're assessing proximally and distally, trying to determine where our reconstitution zones are and making that our target to get that patient out of trouble. And so, you know, once we identify where our targets are, the question is always then, you know, is this a better endo case, or is this a better case where we should be considering a surgical intervention early on? And that is, you know, typically something that we'll just discuss. If my surgeon's up there, I might say, hey, you know, SFA looks like it's out. I've got some reconstitution in the tibials. It looks pretty soft. I think I could try to cross it and then make my next decision as far as treatment modality. Or, you know, I don't see much. You know, I don't know where my best reaccess point would be, or sorry, reconstitution zone would be, in which case we have a lower threshold for a little bit more exploration, perhaps surgically, if it looks like that limb is very, very threatened. But I think the majority of our cases, you know, we can find a zone to get to and try to manage it endovascularly.
So if you decide that the patient is like an endovascular candidate, at this point you have like a diagnostic catheter in, maybe you're up and over with an end hole, but you have a 5 French in the contralateral groin. What is, what are the next steps? And there's a lot, there's so much like I want to ask at this point, but what's your next step?
You know, to me, it matters on where the level of occlusion is and, so to speak, how much thrombus I think is there. The cases that really worry me are, you know, if you just have complete tibials out and you don't know what to get into distally, you know, the question is this somebody that should maybe have, and I'm going to back up to what I said when I don't see a good distal reconstitution zone, is this somebody that you should potentially have, you know, Fogarty balloons exploring the tibials in the OR? Because if you can't find a distal reconstitution zone that you know you will get back through and through and create a channel of flow. Sorry about that. So if you cannot find a channel of flow to reconnect to, then I think your interventional techniques from an endovascular perspective can be limited. Now, if I see a large clot burden in a large iliac artery, there's always concerns about, am I going to get enough out or am I going to shower? I've personally had success using thrombolytic catheters in those cases. I'm sure many of us have. And, you know, you certainly can also consider ephemeral exploration and a retrograde approach with a surgeon in the OR. So you just got to be honest. I will typically try to cross those. So getting back, I'll change out my 5 French system to 6 or 7, whatever I think I need, and then proceed. If I think it's primarily going to be a lytics case, Kristen, I generally would like to just try to cross and keep everything 6 French, just minimize my footprint. And if it's something that I need a little bit more robust device or do something mechanical, then we'll aim for 7. And that's the general start. If it's a smaller vessel series, then I can still choose a different device based upon what I think.
Okay. So let me just stick with large vessel, fairly large clot burden, but are appropriate for lytics. You cross. Can you give the audience and members any kind of sense of when you are crossing what you hope is clot, what you hope that your wire does, or what you're looking for, with the wire, what does your interventional exam look like? What are you trying to ascertain with that?
Yeah, I love the term. So, it's the feel of the wire. I don't want to have to use very aggressive wires and loop them and push with a lot of pressure, right? If this is relatively fresh thrombus, the acuity of that clot should allow me to cross it very easily with a wire. And so I generally my workhorse would be a soft glide, just because I feel like I have good feedback with that. It might not be enough. You might need a stiff angle glide, or some might prefer more of a woolly, but for me, glide gets through clot better. I generally would keep my profile 0.35 if I'm working in the iliacs anyway. So a soft glide with a contralateral sheath kind of just perched in the iliac, if I can, in the common iliac, that is, and then just try to cross with a 0.35 wiring catheter, or take your pick, right? CXI or a trailblazer, and try to make my way through and through. If you don't have a good purchase spot for your crossover sheath, change the game a little bit, right? You don't know exactly where your ostium takeoff is, or even if you do, are you going to have enough support to get through that? But assuming you can with a soft-bodied wire, then you have treatment options available for fresh thrombus there. And that's where I would probably favor a lytic case, I think.
So if it ends up being a lytic case, how much do you do on the table and how much do you just reserve for, or actually you can just kind of tell us, if you can, Dean, what you like for lytics, where you send them, and then kind of what your protocol looks like if you're just going to drip.
Right. So we drip and we ship to the ICU. I mean, I think that's what most of us do, follow our fibrinogen levels, follow our hemoglobin trends. Usually we'll give up to 5 milligrams of TPA bolus. I typically will use an ECOS catheter. And if they're very tortuous in their iliacs and it's hard to get that intercourse dilate from an ECOS, then I might just use a Craig Mack. I think in those situations, a couple milligrams of TPA up to 5 on the table is reasonable, and then run them at, 0.5 to 1 per hour, depending upon how much clot you think there is, and just reassess quickly. Just make sure you're on top of that patient, following their levels and making sure there's no signs of bleeding. But as long as I can keep my footprint 6 French, I think that, that makes me happier putting a lytic catheter up and over because I'm minimizing the contralateral bleeding.
Yeah. If you are dripping with TPA, concurrent heparin?
Yeah, why not? Most of the time, I'll just use fixed dose. Just give all the good humors, get some of those procoagulant effects away. But typically just a fixed dose, somewhere 400 to 600 usually works for me, kind of half of what I might do.
All right. So say that lower clot burden, more distal vessel, and you can take your pick, but also a candidate for endovascular therapy. But so what are some of your other options for thrombectomy?
Yeah. So depending upon vessel size here, I really think that, you know, new technology on the market that's great is some of the stuff that is both mechanical and aspirational, right? So Penumbra's been around for a while. There's some good aspiration devices there. I've certainly done some, you know, relitic cases with the AngioJets in the past. But, you know, my go-to at this point has been the Pounce device from Surmodix. I think that it is a very capable device. I would be a little hesitant using it in a like an iliac if it's larger than the footprint of that catheter itself. Same thing with like a Penumbra Lightning system. You know, if you're really looking at a bigger vessel, I want to be able to make sure I get some good wall apposition with the catheter itself so that I can, you know, then you really extirpate clot more efficiently. So that's where, you know, you might choose one versus the other. I think depending upon your nature and what you like to do and or how old you think the clot is, I think you can make good inroads either way.
The Pounce, how big, like, I'm sure it's got an IFU, but what's like vessel size that it can go up to? Or actually both min and max?
Well, so off-label min, there
is, we live off-label.
We live off-label. I'm more afraid of a lack of capture. So the Pounce device, I think, works, you know, really, really well. I would use it in a common femoral artery just slightly above the size of the device. Their product line has a now an LP, which is, I think, goes down to 2 millimeters in size, 2 to 4, if I'm correct. And then there's also the original device, which is down to 3.5 millimeters. So 3.5 to 6. So I've had some success with it, you know, working through the common femoral. So I have some colleagues of mine. And so I really favor it in that site. You know, if you're looking at a bigger iliac that's 9 or so, I worry that I'm just not going to really capture thrombus efficiently. Working down in an SFA and into the tibials is usually no sweat. So I have taken the original device off label, of course, down to around a 3 millimeter, you know, TP trunk or 3.5 millimeter TP. Well, I guess 3.5 would be on label. So 3.5 millimeter TP trunk, and I've had really good results. What I love about it is that you have the ability to typically treat multiple sections with one device as well. So you have a mechanical device that has the ability to really oppose, you know, anything within that size range. So you don't feel like you have to switch out for a smaller catheter to get lower if need be, if that makes sense.
Well, so I'd only I've never actually put my hands on the Pounce, but if you could, would you just like say like for the audience members who've never heard of it and don't know anything about it, can you just give a brief description of like what that catheter looks like? And also, like, is there anything also you need on the back end? Like, is it also like an aspiration component that like hooks up to a canister or anything, or it's all like you pull it into that funnel?
Yeah, so there's no aspiration component. I will say on the back end, what really makes a difference is your sheath. So I favor the Terumo destination sheath in these cases because they have that yeah. So you can pop off the your end port, which makes a difference because as you're pulling, you know, thrombus through and through your sheath, you could just pop that off the back. So I think that's the biggest, you know, back table work there. It comes with a catheter that's an 0.35 lumen catheter. The working platform of the wire is approximately 0.35 as well. And so looking at the product outside the body, you know, you have kind of three main components. You have the nitinol baskets that are mounted on the wire, and you have the what we call the funnel, which is, you know, almost looks like the sheath we see from an Aria, where it has that funnel output ready to trap stuff. And then finally, you have the 0.35 catheter that it comes with it. Your steps are, you know, to cross your lesion like you normally would, you know, get to your zone of reconstitution with an 0.35 catheter and wire. At some point, you can exchange out either for the Pounce catheter. I have been able to deliver the nitinol baskets of this device through a trailblazer just fine, 0.35 trailblazer, that is. Switch out those catheters, leaving just the basket behind, and then you bring in the funnel. And the funnel is then brought down over the basket wire, because the baskets are mounted on the wire. Leave it just where you'd want to protect, proximal to, you know, where your thrombus is, and then just pull slowly in into your baskets and until you get to the point that the baskets themselves are completely within that funnel, and then you just take it out as one unit. There's a little locking feature on the back. Take it out and, you know, rinse and repeat, so to speak.
So you can just keep using the same Pounce device like over and over, like if you need to make three passes or if you need to take it into a different vessel, it's all the
yes.
same device
yeah.
as soon
so
as you change it up.
You're going to take it out of the body and
okay.
you're going to, you know, re-prep it, and then you're just going to, you know, put it back in. You do have to recross, right? So that is you know, that is, you know, the kind of the one thing to remember. Wherever you start working, you have to get back to that spot. Now, the one thing I failed to mention, by the way, is this is a 7 French device. So when you switch for your Terumo destination sheath preferred, my preference that is, you have that sheath back in position. And if you are in a setting where you feel that you don't want to give up wire position, I have done cases where I'll leave a 014 wire down.
Yeah, like a buddy wire.
Like a buddy wire. This is off-label use, of course, because you have to be using on-label with the funnel. But if you can, let's say you, for example, you have a thrombus and an SFA that is in the mid portion and you're worried about recrossing because it was a little difficult to get through the first time. So, you know, your options are, of course, you know, make a small channel with a balloon or you leave something downstream. So I would typically, in that case, choose a spider just so I have embolic protection, a spider filter wire, leave that distal. And now just bring in my 035 catheter through my 7 French sheath with the baskets, cross and then pull back with the sheath a little bit more deep seated. And I just do that so that I don't pull thrombus back into zones I don't want it to be in. And then from there, you can just, you know, flush your sheath out really well and then go back in and usually a pass or so. And you're going to be using the device completely with the funnel baskets and the funnel and baskets. Fresh thrombus is not an issue. It's more of these subacutes that you're crossing that you're a little worried about a channel.
Okay, fair. Thinking about like tips, also I should ask, is there in your practice, and you know, we're only talking about your practice, do you like any of the aspiration devices? I was thinking like Penumbra, AngioJet.
Yeah, so I used to be a pretty big AngioJet guy. To be honest, I mean, it's a matter of I changed hospital systems and they didn't support much AngioJet. So I don't like to be a one-trick pony. I like to make sure that I'm comfortable with a couple different technologies just because. I mean, I think I've worked at a total of 6 different hospitals at this point, you know, between 2 jobs. So, you know, labs are going to staff things and differently and they're going to stock things differently. So I've become a little chameleon. With that said, you know, I've certainly had good success with, you know, the AngioJet line in the past. But, you know, more recently, it's been, if I'm using aspiration technologies, it's Penumbra. And you know the Penumbra system has been fine for some cases as well, but it, you know, I think it all depends on your goals of what you're trying to achieve with that thrombectomy case.
Is IVUS a part of the practice?
Huge. I mean, the decision in the case is basically made in my book by IVUS. If you're, I don't want to use the term efficient, but if you're a pretty regular IVUS user and you're, you know, comfortable with looking at different morphologies, I find that anything that looks a little bit more subacute, more wall adherent. I mean, I want to go mechanical all day long because I think that having a basket that's going to oppose that vessel wall is going to really extirpate clot much better than if I'm trying something aspiration. And I think that's where differences come into play as far as what device you use and when. Because in my book, if it's fresh thrombus, there's a lot of tools that'll work, right? We can drip, we can aspirate, we can pull, we can do a lot of different things.
A lot of roads to success.
A lot of roads, right? A lot of roads to Rome. But when you have a scenario where there is certainly some subacute disease state that you're trying to manage in a patient, and maybe this isn't an ALI patient, Chris. Maybe this is somebody with a little bit more you know, critical limb ischemia but had a recent closure. And I can give you an example of that as well. But in those situations, I find that IVUS helps not only determine where I am as far as did I cross subintimally or not, but, you know, where's the area that I have to be mindful of for wall-adherent thrombus or wall-adherent gunk, you know, whatever we're trying to get out.
Very nice. As far as the actual procedure goes, without like drilling down too far, like on any single device, is there anything like I kind of left out? I do have a couple more questions about procedure, but anything that I left out as far as like device-specific questions, like things that you like to consider that may shift you one way or the other, or... We kind of already did talk about like when you may like shift towards mechanical thrombectomy, maybe you have something subacute, but is there anything else I skipped?
Not really. I mean, I think the biggest decision tree points are the acuity is probably number one. Two is size, reference size of the vessel. Am I on label? Am I not, you know, with any device here? And am I going to get efficient thrombectomy? And then I think the third is what are the side branches that I need to protect? And how does that come into play with the procedure?
So my two last questions for the actual procedure are collaterals, like the location of clot, and then what you have to be considering like whenever you're actually doing your thrombectomy. And the other is like kind of endpoint. But can you talk a little bit about what you're considering as far as when you're treating and like your collateral flow, either upstream or downstream?
Clarify that. I mean, in terms of collateral flow that I'm trying to protect, or
yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Is like so you have a clot in a certain location. What are you considering like when you're treating to not jeopardize like those other branches that are nearby that are that's your collateral flow?
Sure. So I think with different techniques, you might approach things differently, but let's stick to mechanical. So what I like with this mechanical system is the funnel. Well, there's reasons I like it, but the funnel itself, I think, is my little safety net. So, you know, you can park that just distal to that collateral you're trying to protect. You can park it into, let's say, you know, a below the knee branch, and then you're just directing your thrombectomy into that one target zone and then protecting these side branches so that you don't jeopardize them. So I think, you know, that is a factor that would weigh more into me choosing this mechanical device. I'm sure there's plenty in the audience that'll disagree and say, you know, hey, I do a great job with aspiration, being mindful of collaterals. And that's probably operator use dependent, and that's fine. But if you have one technique that works for you, you know, I guess stick with it, but I like this option.
And the other thing I was going to get at is, as far as like treating clot proximal to distal?
That's a great question. I think if you're really using this technology, the mechanical technology, and even now with aspiration, I think I've always been of the mindset of starting more proximal to working distally, which, you know, I think in the interventional cardiology training was always you start distal and work prox. This is a situation where, you know, I want to use that obstructed outflow, you know, kind of as my safeguard as I debulk what's ahead of me. And I don't want to just plow through, you know, that street and then just try to, you know, deal with the aftermath of things showering. I want to just start proximally, you know, debulk thrombus, take another interval picture, try to decide, run your IVUS down again, see where your level of, you know, open vascular structure is now, and then just keep working. So prox the distal.
So my next line of questioning is kind of along like endpoint. Like when are you done with the case? Assuming, so I have a lot of questions about this, but like I'll just start you off with like lay it like an opening question. Like when are you done? What's your endpoint?
Great question. You know, so inline flow to my foot is the first place of being done. It's always hard when you're looking at somebody's leg and you're thinking, well, there's probably three open tibials now and I only have one good one or two. But, you know, I think, you know, as long as I have a good major vessel to the foot and let's say they have a pedal loop that's intact, then, you know, I'm going to get that person out of trouble and I should be okay being done, provided I've, you know, debulked enough thrombus to have inline flow. I don't necessarily use IVUS to determine what I'm completely done, but I might use it to determine one trouble segment and when that's clear. So, you know, those are, you know, techniques and tools that we might vary with, but I think it's judging the degree of outflow to that foot and making sure that it's sufficient to heal. That's what I'm done.
So if you do have inline flow, so say it's a single session treatment, you had a decent clot burden, but you feel like you removed a good bit and maybe there's some small pieces that got showered a little bit, but they're non-flow limiting. Is the situation, if you have what you kind of believe to be good inline flow, that everything comes out and you close, or do you ever have a situation where you bring that patient back either later the day or next day for a repeat angio to see if there's anything to tune up?
Depends on what the situation is. So, you know, for instance, I just had a case where it was actually an occluded GSV in situ graft, and it was one single outflow AT. My partner actually started that case first, used thrombolytics throughout the graft, and then got good flow into the AT. But the concern was we needed this graft to stay open, right? So with one single outflow vessel, knowing that the patient previously had a good tibial system, you know, we brought the patient back for a relook angio with the goal to go ahead and treat the TP trunk. TP trunk had some thrombus in it. I actually treated that with a Pounce LP, got some subacute looking stuff out, got back through the TP trunk and helped the outflow to that system. So those are going to be the cases where, you know, you're going to, you know, be questioning, do I have enough? And that particular patient was admittedly not ALI, it was CLI, and the patient had a wound. So I need to promote wound healing there. The cases that we do one index treatment, be it, you know, mechanical or aspiration, and you think you've got good flow, I'm not done with antithrombotic treatment at that point. I mean, those patients are going to, they're going to go back on heparin, and then we, you know, we'll just reassess and then decide, is it, you know, do they need repeat imaging? And if so, you know, CT, or should we bring them back and take a look? You know,
okay,
it depends.
Fair. So procedure's done. Let's just say you close, you think you get a good result, good inline flow. Do all these patients, just Lex, a lot of questions, kind of long post-op care, do they all end up in the ICU or a step-down unit or even floor?
That's a great question. So the one thing I think that's nice about not using lytics is I can avoid an ICU stay, provided, you know, I have a good salvageable result. I mean, salvageable foot as a result. So, you know, if the patient, you know, is feeling better, they're moving, and I can just keep them on some anticoagulants and then put them in a step down unit, awesome, right? Avoided an ICU stay, got the patient out of trouble, you know, potentially decreased the hospital stay. I've had success with that in, you know, some AFib embolization cases that were fresh thrombus without much residual disease. So you get through, you take care of the thrombus, and then you go ahead and just park them in the step down unit because you had a nice result with your mechanical thrombectomy. Those that, you know, certainly have a lot of clot burden, you know, we know they're going to go probably to an ICU with a lytic catheter in. The majority of these patients, provided they're stable, yeah, you're going to close, you're going to keep them on anticoagulation, and you're going to get them up as soon as you feel that they can, and then just keep them moving and hopefully decrease that hospital stay.
As far as follow-up goes, so once they're uneventful hospital stay, they're out the door, they follow up with you, sometimes you, hematology, vascular surgery, like what does the follow-up care look like for these guys?
Yeah, so it depends on, you know, what the issue is. I love that you mentioned hematology. I'm pretty quick to get a hematologist involved in a thrombus case. I just think it's good routine care. You know, they may or may not offer, you know, a new diagnosis that needs to be treated, but, you know, in the least you have another good head in the case. Usually our vascular or surgical crew will follow the patient in-house, and, you know, depending upon the result and what else needs to be done, if it's a pretty straightforward, hey, this was an embolism case, it's clear, the roads are open, we've got good runoff, they probably shouldn't have any more issues, they might just sign off and not follow the patient again in the hospital, then I'll see them and help manage them. If they have residual disease and there's a chance that they're going to still need further interventions, they're routinely seen then by myself and one of our cardiovascular surgical colleagues.
If you had to ballpark, like how many of these patients end up, like patients with acute limb ischemia end up like in your... the care, like as kind of in like the vascular path care paradigm, like what ballpark of patients end up like kind of seeing you repeatedly and end up needing procedures for, like, say CLI or even coronary or anything like that, like just the vascular paths who like end up being repeat customers?
Yeah, it's going to depend on the presentation, right? But, you know, if it's an AFib embolization, they pretty much routinely are going to follow up with me because, you know, I'll provide the cardiac care as well. Those that are primary vascular cases or, you know, have significant CAD, I'm still going to follow them and manage the risk factors. So I would say that a large part of these patients, at least a third or more, are going to continue on with me.
So taking a little bit of a left turn, just wanted to talk about complications. So I like to divide it up into two groups. Like, can you talk about the most common complications that you see with this? And then I want to talk about, like, you know, like, this is like the absolute worst complication. This is like exactly what I'm trying to avoid with every step of my procedure.
I love talking about complications. So
yeah, right. That's like everyone's favorite.
You know, when you're at a meeting and there's complication talk, like that's the packed house, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, if we're speaking about complications from any thrombectomy case, I mean, certainly the biggest is going to be bleeding. I mean, I think anytime you're managing a patient on multiple blood thinners and you're putting catheters in arteries, I mean, there's a risk of bleeding, no doubt about it. And those are the ones that we fear. It, because, you know, patients can get really debilitated from a couple of bleeding events. So that is, you know, kind of always in my background, in my brain as, you know, something I need to be the most mindful of. But, you know, technical mediated complications, I mean, fortunately if we're speaking just about this mechanical device, I haven't had any that I would, you know, write down on the board and say this is a terrible complication. But I think anytime you're working on a vessel structure, you're obviously at risk for the classic, you know, dissection causing a worse flow, or simply just, you know, pushing things downstream and worsening that embolic debris. I find that, you know, without disrupting a large clot burden and just, you know, starting slowly and working, you can minimize, you know, working proximal distal, I think you can minimize that embolic risk. And I think that that goes with, you know, aspiration techniques as well. So I think that's always a concern. And so it, as long as you work, you know, steadily in that methodology, I think things can go pretty smooth. The other, I'll call it a complication, but it's really more of a miss was, you know, where was your clinical insight in this case? If you have a patient that you think should have had a, or was a candidate for an endovascular technique, but you're not following them closely and they develop a compartment syndrome, that would be a problem, right? So that would be something that you really have to not ever miss. So these patients, you know, no matter what you do, I think you have to, you know, not walk out of the cath lab and, you know, or IR suite and be like, that's it, you know, we're done, yay, right? You have to, you know, round on those patients, you know, for the next, that day a couple of times, and then later on the next couple of days just to ensure that, you know, that they're recovering. And, you know, if you miss a failed recovery because of, you know, some sort of increased pain, compartment type syndrome, you've really done that patient a disservice because you brought them to a state of betterment and then you didn't complete the care. So that's, you know, those are the things I worry about. And those are the things I look for the most. And I think that's also why, you know, we have our surgeons following too, because if those sorts of things develop, you know, they're on hand to manage it. Yeah.
Well said. So we're coming up at the hour. I want to ask, any good articles that you've come across, like if someone would like wanted to get into this, or say like they just joined a cardiology practice like yours, and they're like, oh man, I never had to do any limbs. I've always been doing like coronary work, and now you guys are throwing me into this, like, you know, the cold like cold pool. Like, can you give anyone some advice on just here's some helpful papers that like can kind of get you started and point you in the right direction. Like, and also think about
the,
it from
cold
like
lake.
Yeah, and also like think about it from like the trainee standpoint. Like anything that you like.
I thought you were going to say cold leg club. You know, I thought you were going to go there. It's like, oh, I don't like that club.
Sure.
I don't have any particular articles that stand. I mean, there's always EVT supplements on different technologies, and you can read about success stories of cases. And, you know, you can obviously read back some classic articles on just, you know, thrombus development. I think it's good to read about, you know, thrombus development, understand, you know, the fiber deposition, when that starts to occur, get a better understanding of the fact that, you know, not all clot is the same, that you're going to have, you know, different, you know, fiber and polymer sizes that make certain things, you know, tougher to treat. It's not anything you're going to diagnose in the cath lab, but just it helps your understanding of knowing where you are in that process so that when you're faced with a patient presentation, you can try to think, you know, where are we? Are we early in this clotting process where we have a limb ischemia that's been a little bit more subacute? Or are we really early or are we late? And that will help make your decision. If you're really late and you feel that it's a better bypass candidate, good. You know, make that decision and talk to your surgical colleagues about it. But I think the biggest thing is just, you know, find a friend and phone a friend. I mean, I came out of my interventional cardiology training still calling colleagues that I'm sure you did when you came in the IR world.
Absolutely.
That, you know,
absolutely.
That helps you. And, you know, those mentors still stick with me. I'm friends with them and I continue to talk and share cases routinely. And so, having that dialogue and not being all about yourself and having the bravado of I can handle this, but understanding that you're going to be continuing to learn in this patient population for some time, and managing those patients efficiently means, you know, having a contingent of people to work with, bounce cases off of, and make better decisions based upon, you know, common thought, because you're not going to see every scenario right out the gate, especially for the trainees.
Of course. Well said. So, Dean, final thoughts? Anything? Any stone left unturned that I didn't bring up that is a gaping hole in the talk here?
No, I think you did a great job.
Oh, thank you, Dean. All right, appreciate it.
I hope everybody just finds it helpful.
I'm sure that they will. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe, rate the podcast 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us @_backtable on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable is produced and hosted by myself, Aaron Fritz, and co-hosts
Chris Beck,
Sabine Dong,
Michael Barraza,
and Ali Behetti.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz.
Social media and PR by Ann Dang,
Manisha Naganathanahalli,
and Manveer Singh Subli.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kinnebrew.
Intro and extra music is Ripperoo by Skeptic Moon. Find us on Spotify or at local live music venues in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Thanks again for listening.